From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, it's all about the brand. Corporate logos have turned into pop culture icons. We'll talk with journalist Naomi Klein about the global effect of corporate branding and the protest movement it spawned. Also, the Western film classic Shane has been reissued on DVD with new production features. We'll talk about the movie with George Stevens Jr. His father directed Shane. The young George Stevens worked as a production assistant on the set and went on to become the founder of the American Film Institute. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Vice President Al Gore arrived in Los Angeles this afternoon, where he'll be nominated as the Democrats' choice to be president. He was greeted at the airport by his running mate, Senator Joseph Lieberman. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Convention delegates have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of the 2000 Democratic ticket to the city hosting the convention. After a reception and rally featuring the combined Tennessee and Connecticut delegations, those are Gore's and Lieberman's home states, Lieberman will begin final preparations for the most important speech he has ever given. He'll take the stage at the Staples Convention Center sometime after 10 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. Lieberman, the first Jewish member of a major party presidential ticket, will be introduced by his wife, Hadassah Lieberman, who is the daughter of German concentration camp survivors. Lieberman's speech will be followed by the roll call of the states, making Al Gore's nomination official. Gore delivers his acceptance speech tomorrow night. Don Gagne, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Outside the convention hall, about 1,600 people marched on the headquarters of the Los Angeles Police Department to protest police brutality. Earlier today, activists staged a sit-in at the Rampart Station, which has been at the center of an investigation into police misconduct. 30 people were arrested for blocking a public building. Senator John McCain, who had challenged George W. Bush for the Republican nomination, has skin cancer. McCain's office said today the Arizona Republican has been diagnosed with melanoma, the most dangerous form of skin cancer. His advisors say McCain will meet with his doctors tomorrow and Friday to review his treatment options. In 1993, McCain had surgery to remove a cancerous mole that proved to be melanoma. Russian naval authorities are still trying to reach more than 100 crewmen aboard a submarine at the bottom of the Barents Sea. The vessel was damaged over the weekend. The BBC's Stephen Rosenberg has more from Murmansk near the rescue effort.
For the rescue teams battling to save the submarine's crew, this has been a day of deep frustration and growing desperation. Time and time again, underwater rescue capsules were lowered deep into the Barents Sea. The plan, to hook up to the Kursk's escape hatch and provide sailors with a ride to freedom. But each time the capsules edged closer to the stricken submarine, swirling currents swept them away. Rescue teams were also unable to pump vital oxygen supplies into the vessel. It's not clear just how much air is left inside the Kursk. As each desperate attempt ended in failure, hopes began to fade that the 116 sailors trapped inside could be saved.
The BBC's Stephen Rosenberg. Stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow was down 58 points at 11,008. The Nasdaq finished the day up about 9.5 points. This is NPR News. In the words of one economist, inflation remains muted. Bruce Steinberg with Merrill Lynch was commenting on the government's report that the consumer price index rose 0.2% last month. He said it's likely the Federal Reserve policymakers will not raise interest rates when they meet next week. Federal aviation investigators are about to release a final report on the TWA 800 disaster, which killed 230 people 4 years ago. Preempting the official findings, the airline industry released its own report today. NPR's Marianne Akers reports.
The center fuel tank on TWA Flight 800 exploded and ripped the plane apart shortly after it took off from Kennedy Airport. Today's report by aircraft manufacturers and carriers does not pinpoint a cause. Bob Robertson at the Aerospace Industries Association says officials inspected nearly 1,000 other aircraft fuel tanks and found nothing wrong with any of them.
If there were something wrong, then we wanted to go fix that. On the other hand, we don't want to go fix things that ain't broke. And what we're saying is, we haven't found a systemic problem in those tanks.
The National Transportation Safety Board never found the source that ignited the TWA explosion. Even so, the board will release a mammoth report next week and make recommendations on the safety of other aircraft fuel tanks. Marianne Akers, NPR News, Washington.
The FAA is ordering that Boeing 767s be inspected to determine if there's any problem with a mechanism that controls the tail of the plane. Egyptian investigators say they believe a problem might have caused the crash of an Egypt Air jetliner off New England last year that killed all 217 people aboard. U.S. investigators have said they find no evidence of a mechanical problem. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bulgave, in for Terry Gross. The national protest movement that has gathered in Los Angeles this week for the Democratic Convention first coalesced at the meeting of the World Trade Organization in Seattle last year. Though the movement has become an umbrella group for many causes, its initial impetus was to protest the impact of global corporations on the lives of workers and the environment. Canadian journalist Naomi Klein is the author of No Logo, a book which examines the corporate policies that are often targeted by the demonstrators. In No Logo, Klein looks at the growing presence of corporate brands and logos in almost every aspect of our lives. She alleges that corporations have increased their use of contract labor at home and low-wage labor in developing countries to pay for the corporate restructuring this branding requires. Naomi Klein is a syndicated columnist in the Globe and Mail in Toronto. Her writing has appeared in such publications as The Village Voice and The New York Times. The term brand used to mean a logo or name of a product, Wonder Bread, for instance. Naomi Klein says that branding has evolved into something else entirely.
The brand used to tell us something about the product. That was the main purpose that a brand played in the economy, to help us as consumers distinguish from one product to the next. Now what's happening is that brands are now sort of free-floating ideas in the culture. And what companies do is they try to find ideas that are meaningful to us. Community in the case of Starbucks, the idea of sports in the case of Nike, or the idea of global communication in the case of Microsoft. And then their job as global brands is to essentially promote that idea. And this is changing the way companies are organizing themselves, because it's become very expensive to build a truly powerful brand. Because to build a truly powerful brand, what you need to do is you need to build a kind of palatial superstore, and maybe you'll launch a lifestyle magazine to go with it, and you'll try to get your brand into all kinds of Hollywood movies. And what's happening is that the cost of producing the traditional products is being kind of offloaded, and it's largely being offloaded onto the developing world through a web of contract factories. And the idea is that it's no longer really worth the trouble to produce your own products, because what customers buy and value are these ideas that we're all longing for meaning. And that's part of the reason why branding is so successful.
I think that's what's both the insidious part of this story and also the really brilliant part, that branding didn't come out of nowhere, but is rather responding to something in culture, that people look to consumer goods for nourishment, for philosophy, for a lifestyle that they don't find somewhere else.
That's absolutely true. And this quintessential branding success story, it's no longer a success story, but they really pioneered this corporate model, was Nike. And they did it by coming up with an idea, which was this idea of just do it. It was more than a slogan. It was a philosophy, a life philosophy, that they sent out there in the 80s. And it resonated with young people. And I believe it resonated with young people, not because they're stupid and they're drones and they can't think for themselves, but because Nike was speaking to young people in this language of empowerment, telling them, giving them a positive message, and they weren't getting that message for whatever reason from their communities, from their family. The traditional purveyors of meaning in the culture are kind of collapsing, and these corporations are stepping in to fill the gap. But where it becomes insidious is that there is a betrayal inherent in this equation, because I don't believe that Nike truly is selling young people empowerment. What they're actually selling young people are sneakers, no matter what sort of transcendent rhetoric they decide to use. So I also believe that branding is creating its own backlash in a way by selling us our deepest longings, and then, of course, not delivering, because how could they? And in a sense, I think that is, it's very dangerous to play with emotions that run this deep.
Branding really took off in the 80s, the mid-80s, and that was also a time of deregulation and mm-hmm. privatization. And this global marketing strategy does take place in the context of political change. What opportunities did that climate open up for corporations taking the branding path?
Well, the branding explosion really is, as you say, a convergence of several major international forces. One of them was simply that free trade was taking off in the 80s, and it was suddenly possible to produce your goods in these contract factories around the world. It became a lot easier to contract out the act of manufacturing, and there were all sorts of deregulatory initiatives, the creation of free trade zones, maquiladoras, which lifted tariffs and made it easier to import your own product. So on the one hand, it was made easier. On the other hand, government was pulling out of the public sector in various ways. What a brand needs most, if it's to become powerful, is fresh space to express its brand meaning. Because being an idea is very amorphous. So once you decide that you are about the idea of community or the idea of sports or the idea of rock and roll, what you then have to do is you then have to find cultural surfaces on which to express that meaning, or else you'll just float away into nothingness. And it's been very convenient for the branding economy that at the same time as companies have come to this realization that it's more profitable to sell an idea than to sell a product, our public schools have also been starved of public funding. Our community centers have been starved of public funding. The arts have been starved of funding. So there was this convergence of a need for new revenue sources in the school system, in the arts. And there was this merger of the public with the brand, where it seemed like a pretty good deal at the time. We need a new space to express our brand meaning. We need new sources of brand meaning, and you need money. So why don't we help each other out? But what has started to happen is that branding has really overwhelmed public space and public culture to the point of almost eclipsing it. And I think in some ways we're seeing an incredible metaphor for that this week in Los Angeles, where there's all this activity around the Staples Center, and it's sort of taken for granted, of course, that we would be having a political convention inside this corporate branded space, and so we have politics itself being enclosed, the ultimate public sphere being enclosed within the private corporate logo.
What are the cultural effects of this, of having Molson concerts and Pepsi-sponsored schools and a Staples-sponsored arena?
Well, I think there are lots of simultaneous effects, but one of them is that I think a lot of particularly young people are growing up with what I describe in the book as global claustrophobia, a sense of everything being enclosed in some way by branding, whether it's your own body with these fashions that turn you into a Tommy Hilfiger life-size action figure, or having your music concerts be a brand extension for Mentos or something like that. There's a sense of claustrophobia that there's no place left, there's no uncolonized space, and I think that is leading to a desire for release, and we're seeing that desire for release and expressed in lots of ways. I think rave culture is expressing that desire, extreme desire for release. I think extreme sports expresses that desire for release. But I also think we're seeing a burgeoning political culture, which is about reclaiming public space from corporations. And we're seeing it around the world. And I think we're seeing it in Los Angeles this week, where this wave of activism is going after politicians by going after the corporations that fund them and trying to turn politics from a corporate game to a public game again. It sees that most public of spaces, politics itself, democracy itself.
Now, you've investigated many of the free trade zones, or what are called export processing zones, where multinational companies' products are manufactured now in the global economy. And these are the sweatshops that are spurring on the protests. Help me understand, first of all, the fallout for labor as a result of a global-driven economy. Because as I understand it, it was always cheaper to produce goods in developing countries with cheap labor. How is the branding economy or the globalization spurring this on?
Well, it was always cheaper, but it wasn't always quite so easy. What globalization, the kind of global, and I don't want to lump in all globalization, because I think that we have a particular kind of globalization, which is about deregulation. And what it has done is it has created denationalized states within nations where goods are being produced, basically in extra legal situations. I mean, what are the maquiladoras? What are the free trade zones? Well, what they are, they're walled in industrial parks, where the rules that a country has democratically chosen for itself about how much taxes corporations should pay and what sort of tariffs they should pay on import and export, these rules are suspended for this piece of land where these goods are being produced. So it's all about facilitating this process and heaping on incentives. So, for instance, I spent a lot of time in a free trade zone in the Philippines, where corporations were given a 5-year tax holiday. So obviously it's much easier to produce your goods when you're not paying any taxes at all. And then what starts to happen is that countries start competing against one another, and Bangladesh says, well, if you're giving these companies a 5-year tax holiday, then we'll give them a 10-year tax holiday. So when the global economy is explained to us by cheerleaders of this system, they say, well, these jobs are, yes, they're difficult, but they're the first stage in development, and they're going to get better. But what's actually happening is they're getting worse, because so many countries are playing this game of setting up these free trade zones, these denationalized enclaves within their nations where they suspend their own laws, is that we're seeing this very rapid race to the bottom, where minimum wage is dropping in many situations, where you have to heap on ever more incentives in order to compete against your neighbor.
What were working conditions like in the free trade zone that you visited in the Philippines, outside of Manila?
Well, I went to this free trade zone, and it's the largest free trade zone in the Philippines. It's called the Cavite Export Processing Zone, because there had just been a very tragic incident where a worker had died, and all of her colleagues said that she died of overwork. She died on International Women's Day, actually. And I started researching her particular case, and what had happened is that because these factories are all run by, not by companies like Nike and The Gap, but rather they're run by subcontractors who take orders from companies like Nike and The Gap and Reebok, they often get these incredible bottlenecks where they have huge orders that are due from several different clients all at once. And then workers will often work 48 hours in a row. And that's what had happened in this case. And the worker had gotten pneumonia, which is very common inside the free trade zones because they're very, very hot during the day. And then at night when workers stay, there's a lot of condensation because the temperature drops. And she'd gotten pneumonia, and she'd asked to go to the doctor. And she had not been given permission because they had this incredible order that they had to meet. And she eventually collapsed on the job and died at the hospital. So that and when I went to this free trade zone, I found that this was not an exceptional case. And what the message I got from workers over and over again was, what happened to that worker could have happened to any of us, because these are the types of hours we're working, these incredibly intense schedules. And many of them are from the countryside, and they were drawn to these factories with promises that they would be able to make enough money to send home to their families who'd been displaced. And of course, what they were finding was just the opposite, that they were making barely enough money to have 2 meals a day. So there was an incredible exploitation, and there was also a lot of desire on the part of the workers who I met that they felt that consumers who were buying these goods for these exorbitant prices needed to know the conditions under which their goods were being produced. And I see these free trade zones, these export processing zones, as sort of the broom closets of our shiny branding economy.
Naomi Klein is my guest. She writes a nationally syndicated column which appears in the Globe and Mail. She's the author of No Logo, a cultural analysis of global marketing strategies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Naomi Klein. Her book about the global economy and its cultural fallout is No Logo. Now, your work has made you something of a spokesperson for the anti-corporate protest movement. And I think a lot of people's image of the protests were, of course, shaped by the demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle, in which protesters appeared to have no central organization or clear agenda. What about this idea of a lack of coherence in the movement, that it's quite diverse, that the protesters don't have a core philosophy around which they organize?
Well, what I've been tracking for the past 5 years for the book is a shift in activist tactics, essentially, where we have all these issues that activists are concerned with, environmental issues, labor issues, and the like. And traditionally, the way you achieve political change is you go after your own government. You go after politicians. But there's been this kind of global consensus that's emerged, which has said, basically, it's not even worth going after politicians anymore. They're so beholden to corporate interests that if you really want to achieve political change, you have to go after the corporations directly. And what they've found is that using brand image can be enormously effective. Many of these companies have made a concerted decision that their product is going to be their brand image, which leaves them very, very vulnerable to attacks on their brand. So this has been happening around the world. I first started noticing it when labor activists in the United States decided to put the sweatshop issue, which they well knew was not confined to a particular company like Nike, or it wasn't confined to a particular celebrity like Kathy Lee Gifford. But they also knew that it was very hard to get these issues into the media to even get people talking about globalization critically. So what they started to do is they started latching on onto the celebrity of brands like Nike and the celebrity of celebrities like Kathy Lee Gifford, who had themselves become brands, to get these issues on the agenda. Then that started to happen with other issues as well, like genetically engineered foods. Campaigners in Britain started going after the supermarkets that sold genetically engineered food products or brand name food companies like Nestle. And that also achieved very powerful results. And now what's happening is that all these individual campaigns are converging in these mass protests, like what happened in Seattle. So the protests are very confusing to look at from the outside, because it looks as if there's no center whatsoever. And I think that's absolutely true, because this protest movement is, I believe, can be best understood as a physical manifestation of the internet, that all these activists have linked up with each other internationally on the internet and created these little mini campaigns around corporations and around issues, and have come to the conclusion through a very sort of organic cross-pollination process online that there is this common agenda, that all of these campaigns are dealing with global deregulation and increased corporate power. And so they've converged in these sort of celebratory, sometimes riotous protests that don't look anything like a mass protest we've seen before. So police don't know how to react. They don't know how to control it, because it's very cell-based. There's no central leadership. Journalists don't know how to write about it, because it doesn't look like the 60s. There's no Abby Hoffman, and you know, there are very few sort of celebrity leaders who can put a face to it and make it media friendly. So it is confusing, but I think that's not a weakness of this movement. I think that every mass movement of the past has suffered because of its central organization, because of its celebrity-based leadership. Sometimes you suffer simply because your leadership gets shot. Sometimes you suffer because your leadership is corrupt. But this movement is so organic and so much like the internet that, like the internet itself, it's almost impossible to control. It just keeps spreading all over the world.
How effective is it, though? And I'm thinking that the one part of the equation that's missing is that, yes, there's a criticism of globalization or a certain vision of no holds barred free trade. There's the idea that trade must be regulated or linked to democratic reform and labor reform or environmental protections. But the ties don't exist between these protesters that we see in Seattle and Philadelphia and now in Los Angeles and a larger labor movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely right. And what this activism doesn't have is a plan about how to take power, how to take this criticism, because all movements begin with a criticism, but how to take that criticism and turn it into a practical alternative plan. Part of it is that it's so very vast. I mean, we understand how to act on a national scale. But what this is about is a kind of activism that has emerged precisely to be as transnational as capital itself. It's an anti-corporate movement that is responding to the globalization of capital and the deregulation of capital. And so it is itself attempting to be as international as the monetary flows. Now, how do you organize across national borders into something coherent and something that could get serious about putting your critique into action and taking power? And I think we're at the very early stages of trying to figure that out. Some of that is actually starting to happen around the conventions. For instance, yes, there will be people yelling and screaming in the streets and trying to get their voices heard that way. But then there's also these parallel shadow conventions, which are an attempt to mirror the process of a political convention, the process of developing a political agenda with the issues that have just fallen off the agenda. The organizers of the shadow convention believe that it's because these issues all in some way threaten corporate profits, whether it's challenging the privatization of the prison system or demanding campaign finance reform or looking seriously at the growing gap between rich and poor. So they're developing a parallel political structure, which is getting serious about power, which is, you know, it's early stages of possibly creating another party. I don't know. And then you have Ralph Nader's leadership bid, which is also part of this movement, I believe. So I wouldn't write it off yet, but it definitely has its challenges.
Naomi Klein is the author of No Logo. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to the theme from Shane, the Western movie classic directed by George Stevens. Coming up, we meet George Stevens Jr. We'll talk about the movie, which has just been reissued on DVD. And we continue our conversation with Naomi Klein about the tactics of the anti-corporate protest movement. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue now with our interview with Naomi Klein. She's the author of No Logo, a look at the corporate marketing strategy of branding and its cultural and political implications. She describes the protest movement, which grew out of the World Trade Organization demonstrations in Seattle and has continued up until this week's Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, as an anti-branding backlash. I asked her if she feels this new movement's strategies and techniques are effective.
There are a few tracts of protests, a few forms of protests happening, and I think the shadow conventions are an important development in that area, where you have the protests on the streets, but then you also have some people getting very serious about power inside. So I think that's learning from some of the weaknesses of previous mass demonstrations, and I also think that the use of branding, which I call in the book the brand boomerang effect, has proven enormously effective in the sense, that this type of activism hasn't even really been on the public radar for a year yet, and people are already ready to write it off. And I think it's far too soon for that. We've seen, with, for instance, how the anti-sweatshop activism has companies like Nike on the run, has extracted some incredible reforms from universities, where universities have drafted codes of conduct for the types of working conditions that are acceptable to them for the production of their athletic gear, for instance. So there have been real victories. There have been victories around genetic engineering, calls for labeling across Europe, and victories in that way as well. So the question really to me is whether all these very focused campaigns can converge into an alternative vision for what globalization should look like. And I think it's too soon to decide whether that can happen.
You do write about one popular technique of some protest groups, which is called culture jamming. And that, as I understand it, or as I've seen it, it's kind of a parodying or turning the advertising hype against itself. Could you give us some examples of how groups are doing that?
Well, there's actually a magazine in Canada called Adbusters that's solely devoted to parodying advertising. There's some really good ones. There's ones that parody Tommy Hilfiger ads, where they sort of dress up sheep in Tommy Hilfiger clothing. There's some really good parodies of the Think Different campaign from Apple. I've seen actually images from Seattle of protesters clashing with riot police, and the caption is "Think really different." So it's just kind of turning the knob just a little bit, and changing flipping the meaning of an advertising campaign against itself, so that it carries an unintended message. But I believe that culture jamming is part of a move by not all young people by any means, but by a growing group of young people. To reclaim their minds and reclaim their schools and their spaces and their bodies from marketing, and this occurs in a cultural backdrop where we've come to fetishize wealth creation above all else. It was interesting. George Bush said, he said something interesting last week. He said that the Republican Party was going to be about prosperity with purpose. And what was that purpose? It was keeping America prosperous. The idea that money is an end in itself, that money is the message. And I think that there's a growing dissatisfaction with that. You know, looking at what's going on in pop culture, like with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Survivor, and in rap music, where young people are confronted with this idea that music is not about artistic expression, but it's about having wealth, and it's about being able to buy a Mercedes and drink champagne on a yacht like Bill Gates. I mean, the fetishization of wealth has reached truly absurd proportions. And so one of the things that I feel really hopeful about is that you have this generation who a lot of people have written off as being so branded that they couldn't possibly have a political bone in their body. These are the kids who grew up with commercials in their classrooms, who were supposed to aspire to nothing more than to be a dot-com millionaire by the time they're 18. And they're saying to the politicians, you know, we do want space that isn't colonized by corporations.
Naomi Klein, thank you so much for talking today on Fresh Air.
It's great to be here.
Naomi Klein's book is No Logo. Coming up, we remember the Western classic Shane. It's just been reissued on DVD. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. According to director Sam Peckinpah, the 1952 classic Shane was the best Western ever made. He said it changed violence in Westerns forever. The movie, directed by George Stevens, won an Academy Award for Best Cinematography in 1953. It's now out in DVD with restored color and sound, and a commentary track by the director's son, George Stevens Jr., talking with the associate director of the movie, Ivan Moffat. The film follows the adventure of a lone gunman, Shane, played by Alan Ladd, as he turns in his six-shooter to help out the Starrett family, homesteaders in the Wyoming wilderness, who are embroiled in a confrontation with a gang of local land barons. Although Shane tries to leave his violent past behind him, he comes to the aid of the homesteaders and picks up his guns once again. By the end of the film, Shane rides off into the sunset, a lone rider once again.
I gotta be going on.
Why, Shane?
Man has to be what he is, Julie. Can't break the mold. I tried it and it didn't work for me.
We want you, Shane.
Joey, there's no living with a killing. There's no going back from one. Right or wrong, it's a brand. A brand sticks. There's no going back. Now you run on home to your mother and tell her. Tell her everything's all right. There aren't any more guns in the valley.
George Stevens was one of the leading directors of his era. His films include The Diary of Anne Frank, A Place in the Sun, and Giant. George Stevens Jr. started working with his father on films when he was 17. He went on to become the founder and director of the American Film Institute, where he produced documentaries, awards galas, including the Kennedy Center Honors, and was behind the restoration of many film classics, including his father's works. Stevens also produced and directed a documentary about his father's life, George Stevens, A Filmmaker's Journey. Stevens had read Jack Schaefer's novel Shane as a young teenager. I asked him if he was the person who introduced his father to the story.
I believe I was. I was working with him that summer. It was my first job, really, and I had two jobs. One was to, quote, break down Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy, listing all the incidents and scenes and characters, because my father was preparing to work on the script of the movie based on that novel that became A Place in the Sun with Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor and Shelley Winters. And the other part of my job was to read material that came from the studios, from the studio, Paramount, books and scripts. And there were a lot of what I remember as a 17-year-old, what I disdainfully called love stories that didn't interest me. But I did read Jack Schaefer's small novel. And the next night I went over and went in my father's bedroom and he was in bed and I said, you know, this is a really good story. I said, I think you ought to read it. And he said, tell me the story. And so I remember pacing around his bedroom trying to tell him the story of Shane. And of course I told it as a 17-year-old would see it, and he added levels and dimensions that made it into a quite extraordinary film.
What do you think he saw in the movie? And I'm thinking that your father made Shane after coming home from World War II.
Yeah, he talked about coming home from war. He'd been away for 3.5-4 years, and his combat motion picture unit, they'd been at D-Day and the liberation of Paris and the liberation of the concentration camp at Dachau, and he'd seen a lot of combat. And he came home and had seen one movie in 4 years, and he started going and looking at pictures, and he saw Westerns, and he said they were using six guns like they were guitars. You know, they'd shoot at people, and they'd fall down, and they'd get up again and start shooting. And one thing he wanted to do in this film was to show the power of a single bullet and what it does to the human form. And that, of course, was done so memorably in the scene in front of the saloon where Jack Palance shoots the little Southerner, played by Elisha Cook Jr.
Well, when people shot in Westerns, I noticed they usually fell forward before Shane. They'd kind of fall on their face. And in that scene, and in the two other scenes, there are only three scenes in which people get shot in Shane. In the other scenes, people fall backward really violently. It's such a different effect. That must have been a big break with tradition. Did your father use any kind of trick technique to make people fall so fast backwards?
Well, I remember the day that scene was shot. It was meant to be shot on a Saturday, and the street wasn't wet enough. So we called off shooting, and my father had them water the street all night, that little street in front of that one, you know, that town with buildings only on one side. And they buried a mattress in this muddy street, and they put a harness around Elisha Cook's chest and connected it to a wire and had three strong prop men or grips holding the handles on the wire, and when he was shot, they pulled him, and he snapped back and fell into the mud.
Huh. Did your father also experiment with the sound of gunshots?
Yes. He would be shooting, had them shooting guns in trash barrels, and, you know, to give the sound a kind of ferocity that a gun can have. I mean, today, it sounds quaint, really, to think back today where the Dolby sound and sounds are so exaggerated, and, you know, it's so deafening to go to a movie theater and watch the previews. But then this was a real enhancement of the sound, and and to use it only occasionally, it had such an impact when it was the first gunshot you heard in the film. Actually, the second. There's a little scene where Shane is teaching Jody, the little boy, how to shoot. But very little gunplay, but when it comes, it's very dramatic.
The Wyoming landscape in the movie is so pervasive. It's almost as if it's a character in the film. I'm curious how conscious your father was in the cinematography and setting shots up that those Wyoming mountains would have such presence in every shot possible.
I remember when we flew up to scout locations, and we'd drive out in station wagons, and Dad would walk along, you know, the hills and in the valley in front of those Teton Mountains. Until he found just the right place. And part of it was that there was two trees that on a hill that kind of became a signature, that every time horses came through those trees and down the hill, you immediately knew you were headed for town. And then the town was built on this street in front of the Tetons. And he used long photo-length lenses to photograph much of Shane, including the scenes of the actors in just normal scenes, not in landscape scenes. And it had the effect of pulling those three Teton peaks up closer, and it gave them that looming presence over the scenes that were taking place in front of it.
I love Jack Palance in this film. Just brilliant casting. He was a New York stage actor then. Had he even been out west before showing up to shoot Shane?
You know, I don't know if he'd been out west. He was in a very good film called Panic in the Streets that Elia Kazan directed. And Kazan obviously had seen Palance in the theater. But when he came out to work on this film, he was Jack Palance was then a rather mysterious man, and he had these extraordinary dark looks. And even on days when he wasn't called to work, Jack would be out on the set, and he'd be doing two things. One, he'd be getting on and off his horse, the horse he'd been given to use in the film, and he would be standing and doing, drawing his pistol out of his holster. And day by day, he would do that. And after a couple of months, the Western experts that we had, the cowboys out there, said his fast draw was in the league with the best. And he brought to it such he worked hard on the role and brought to it such a menace that I think it's really an extraordinary performance, and it showed signs that he was going to be an important actor in the future.
You said he was a mysterious man. Is that how you felt about him when you met him?
Well, he was. He was big and, you know, unusual looking. But as you got to know him, he was, you know, and as we've seen later with the Billy Crystal movie and other things, he's a man with a wonderful sense of humor. But I think he was into that role. I think that he's a method actor, and he was out there night and day living as a gunfighter.
Let's talk about the costumes. How strict was your father about period detail in Chain, in just all areas of the film?
He wrote a memo to the crew, particularly to the production designers, the costumers. He didn't really like the word costumes. He used to call it clothing because he thought costumes kind of led people to be elaborate. And he said that if somebody came from another planet and landed at that on the set, that we'd like them to feel that this was Wyoming in 1879. And I remember Van Heflin had a shirt that he'd worn in another film where he played Jim Bridger, a Western figure, and he wanted to wear this shirt. And he brought it in and showed it to Dad, and Dad looked at the label, and it said Abercrombie and Fitch. And it was just a very contemporary-looking shirt. And if you look at Chain, and instantly the restored print that is used to make this DVD, you know, the color and texture are back. The clothes are worn. The people didn't go to the store every day, and they wore clothes till they wore out. And I think it gives a great sense of reality to what life was like for the homesteaders out in Wyoming in that time.
My guest is George Stevens, Jr. He's the founder of the American Film Institute and the son of the late director George Stevens, whose movies include I Remember Mama, A Place in the Sun, Giant, and Shane. Shane has just been released on DVD. The DVD version includes commentary from George Stevens, Jr., who worked with his father on the film. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with George Stevens, Jr. He's the founder of the American Film Institute. His father was the director of such movies as Giant, A Place in the Sun, and the Western classic Shane. Shane is just out on DVD. I'd like to talk about the restoration of Shane, but first you should probably explain that Shane was shot with something called a three-strip Technicolor process, which was new way back when in the 50s. What did that process involve and involve for the shooting?
The three-strip Technicolor process relied upon huge cameras. You know, they were big cameras so that three strips of film could run through them parallel at the same time. And then you had to put the sound blimps to so the noisy camera didn't interfere with the dialogue. And so there were these large cameras. And when you think of the fight scenes in Shane and all of those, you know, in the saloon with so many small cuts, that this was not, as it is today, a cinematographer with a camera on his shoulder grabbing little pieces of film. Each one was moving this big camera around and setting it up and lighting it. Again, the film speed was much slower today, so it needed more light. But the result was that with the three strips of film going through the camera representing the different colors, they were later combined to make the color film. Later on, Eastman developed a process which is used today, a single-strip process for color film. But this was in the days of the three-strip Technicolor. And most people feel that that nothing has matched the quality and the wonderful resolution of color that the Technicolor process had.
Now, when you worked on the restoration of the picture, I know you've produced documentaries about your father. You certainly mm-hmm. thought long and hard about your father mm-hmm. and his techniques. Were there any surprises or new angles or new insights into his technique that you noticed?
I'll tell you one thing. You have to be careful when you're preserving a film because the technology is so good now. You can do so much with sound. You can do so much with color. Fortunately, Shane is a picture that's been part of my life since it was made, and I know what it looks like, and I know what it's supposed to sound like. I worry about technicians, because there was one stage when the technicians had done some sound work. They'd cleaned up the sound, sonically cleaned the sound, and it took the life out of it. It took the sound of the creek that's gurgling in the background out. So people who take on the responsibility of preserving films have to remember that their job is to try and restore the film as close to what the original filmmaker produced, not to get little ideas of their own and say, oh, I'm going to make it better or different.
My guest is George Stevens, Jr. He's the son of the great late director George Stevens, director of such films as I Remember Mama, A Place in the Sun, Giant, and Shane. Shane is just out on DVD. George Stevens, Jr. Has a commentary on the new DVD restored version and worked on the restoration. After you worked with your father on Shane, on Giant, on a number of his films, on The Diary of Anne Frank, you worked in television in your own right. You worked for Jack Webb for a while mm-hmm. on Dragnet. Now, how cool is that? What did you do?
That was great. I'd just gotten out of the Air Force. I'd been a motion picture officer in the Air Force, and I needed a job. And I was fortunate to get a job with Jack Webb, who then was making the hottest show on television, Dragnet, in which he starred as Sergeant Joe Friday. And I worked with Jack on another series he did called Pete Kelly's Blues and two movies that he made. And Jack was at the other end of the spectrum from my father in his approach to his work. They both did fine work, but Jack was... Dad shot a lot of film, shot a lot of angles, took his time. Jack was Mr. Efficiency. He even used teleprompters. He and Ben Alexander, the other character, would do so skillfully. They'd have him stuck in the sets, and they'd shoot 10 pages of dialogue in 3 hours. So it was a wonderful learning experience for me to work with Jack.
Was that seductive for you then, to see this other end of the spectrum?
It was. I always was more drawn to my father's way of doing it, but I learned, and it enabled me to direct Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Peter Gunn and the shows that I directed with an efficiency that I wouldn't have learned from my father in the latter stages of his career.
You founded the American Film Institute in 1967. Was the initial mission of the Institute to restore and preserve film?
It was. It was really had several. One was film education and training, the preservation of films and the exhibition of films. And at the time we started it, half the films that had been made since the beginning of film in the United States were lost, missing, or had been destroyed. And it was a huge job to try and rescue these missing films. And then we were thinking about the films of the teens and the 20s and the 30s. What never occurred to me was that while we were doing that work, that what were then quite recent films, like Shane and A Place in the Sun, were deteriorating in the studio library. And so here we are restoring, I find out later on that here I am restoring the films of my father's that never occurred to me would be in danger. But the AFI effort at film preservation and restoration, I think, was a very significant act, because it wasn't that the AFI did it all, but the AFI was able to energize and give focus to the other museums and archives who were willing to do the work and were doing good work.
George Stevens, Jr., thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, I enjoyed it. It was a great pleasure.
George Stevens, Jr. is the founder of the American Film Institute. He provides commentary on the new DVD reissue of his father's 1952 Western, Shane. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Seuss Bolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, while the demonstrations in Los Angeles continue, some protesters from the Republican National Convention have filed complaints about alleged police abuse. We'll check in on the story with two Philadelphia journalists. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.